As season 5 comes to an end, our best season to date, thank you everybody who has downloaded every episode and continues to listen to the Clink Stories of Redemption. Our last episode for this season is going to be dedicated to a wonderful man who we lost, someone who came into season 1 and gave us a wonderful story of redemption, Bernie Matthews. Rest easy, old friend, and our condolences and thoughts go out to your loved ones and family. Enjoy Bernie Matthews' story of redemption.
For the record, I'm done trying to make y'all comfortable. That's right. For the record, you ain't trying to grow, then it's done for you. That's right. For the record, lab on me going all the way. All the way. For the record, ain't trying to link, no time to waste. Stop calling. For the record, 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 for the record. For the record, I'm done trying to make y'all comfortable.
Welcome to the Clink, Stories of Redemption. This is part 2 of Bernie Matthews' story. Now, if you missed the first part, head back to our episode 3 and catch up. Right now, let's pick it up from where we left off when Bernie was telling me about Katingle and what it was really like.
I guess the best way, as I said, it's like living in a submarine where the longest pace you could walk in a straight line was 21 steps. That was it. That was it. You didn't see a blade of grass. You didn't see a bird. You didn't see anything. That was it. You saw concrete walls. That's it.
How long did they have you in there for, Bernie? Well, I know you were there longest out of anyone. And how long was it?
2 years, 8 months.
Jeez. And that would have felt like fucking 10 years.
Now, in 1976, they started the Royal Commission. Now, of course, all the screws that were jumping up and down and, they were blowing about what was happening, what caused the Bathurst riot. Then they got to Grafton. The Department of Corrective Services denied that there was ever any brutality at Grafton. They had us all in Katingle. Now, they figured, well, that's it. Grafton's cloaked in secrecy. It'll never, ever come out. Well, they made a sad mistake. One of the screws found a pang of conscience. His name was Pettit.
Okay.
And he gave evidence at the Royal Commission. And his evidence was, and I can't remember it word for word, but I remember this. He said, yes. He said, there was a reception biff. He said, and the reception biff was 4 or 5 of us prison guards would attack the prisoner as soon as he was stripped naked. They would be batten whipped, either unconscious or semi-conscious, and in some cases they would urinate or defecate. And that was standard policy for the whole time I was there.
Wow.
And once he gave his evidence, the whole facade crumbled. The next ones to give evidence were, well, the Screws Union, their rep got up and he said, look, he said, on behalf of the Prison Officers Association, we concede that there was brutality at Grafton, but they offered the Eichmann defence. We're only following orders. We're following orders from
the head office. Passing the buck.
Well, see, the Eichmann defence was quite simple. Adolf Eichmann said, I never dropped one Cyclone B canister into the gas chamber at Auschwitz. All I did was sign the papers, and the Israelis hung him, but they maintained the Eichmann defence and said, oh, well, look, we're only following orders from head office, and not one of them were charged.
It's only 4:15 in the afternoon, and dinner is being served. Within half an hour, before the sun has set, these men will be locked away. A jail wing is an eerie place at night. How people can ever contemplate escape with an image like this. It looked to me like a submarine, airtight. The prisoners stay like this for 17 hours of every day. One prisoner told me if you're serving a 12-month sentence, 9 months are spent like this.
So you get out of Katingle?
There's more to the Katingle story.
Yeah.
September 1977. I ended up cracking up in there. I cracked up, but had enough.
Yep.
And I set fire to the place. What I didn't know was that the linoleum that they had on the floor was
toxic,
produced toxic fumes. Oh, I didn't know that. Anyway, I barricaded myself in the workshop. I talked to the other boys. I said, mate, I said, I've had enough of this shit. And Fred and Earl and that said, listen, Bernie, said, you know, calm down, you know, go to your, you know, go to the, says, ah, fuck it, I've had this shit.
Yep.
Anyway, I torched the place. nearly wiped out everyone in the place with the fumes. I didn't know. And the boys were sticking their head down the shit house to get fresh air out of the sewerage pipes. Anyway, the screws came in, they flogged me, battered me unconscious, took me to the ABS, had me hidden in there for about a week. Then, of course, it was about 3 weeks later, then Russell escaped. Well, of course, when that's happened, the whole shit hit the fan.
So this is Russell Mad Dog Cox?
Yeah.
Right, well, he's escaped from Katingle.
Meet Russell Mad Dog Cox, a violent gunman, armed robber, prison escapologist, and Australia's most wanted man for 11 years.
Well, of course, when he's escaped, the shit's hit the fan. You know, he's escaped from the escape-proof jail and holy hell's played.
Wow.
Anyway, they saw the screws got back at us. They turned off the air conditioning. They just created havoc with us. So we had no air conditioning for about 3 days over Christmas in 77. And the air conditioning packed up.
Hottest part of the year.
So there was no fresh air coming in.
Fuck.
And then, it was pretty chaotic. Say Christmas 77, early 78, there's about four attempted suicides. One bloke cut himself with a jammed tin lid. One bloke tried to hang himself off the bars. You know, it was just chaos.
Yes.
Then it all came to a head. You know, it was about January. It was just after Christmas. Barry was out in the yard. We were playing paddle tennis, and he fell over. He always reckons I tripped him over to win the game, but I didn't.
Is this the old squash? Over. The old, as I would know it for my dinner, the old paddle squash.
Yeah.
Oh, mate, I remember playing that as a young fella at the Bay. I was all right too. Dave Keller was the machine, but
yeah, he would have been. He was pretty fit in his day.
He was a very fit man, and he could play squash.
What happened then is Barry. Fell over on his ankle. We thought he sprained his ankle. Well, we carried him into the cell. Well, he'd snapped it. Anyway, we said to the screws, you know, you've got to get the male nurse over now. We had no medical in Katingle at all. They had to come from the Bay. Like if anyone was sick in there, they had to ring the hospital at the Bay and they'd send a male nurse over.
Right.
Anyway, so listen, you better get something for Levy because, you know, he's in a bad way. His ankle's, you know, really, really bad. No one would come over. Now, what had happened is the screws had gone on strike at the Bay and the prison medical staff had walked out in sympathy. So there was no prison medical staff in the jail as well.
So full lockdown.
Well, of course, Barry's got a busted ankle and he can't get medical attention and it's really, really bad. He's in a lot of pain. Mm. So it lasted that afternoon. Well, in the end, we all jacked up. So listen, if you don't get a male nurse, we're going to riot. Yeah, you take it or leave it. You know, that's what's going to happen. Anyhow, they called our bluff. We just carried on with it. That's it. We just carried on. Now, we couldn't do much. All we could do was, you know, set fires and carry on. But, you know,
until
he gets medical attention, we're just going to carry right on.
Yep.
Now, if you send a screw in, well, then you're going to have to send six in.
Yeah, bring
back
the squad.
In. Bottom line, they ended up getting the medical over, they came over, they checked him out. They said, listen, they've got to get him to Prince Henry Hospital straight away. He's in a bad way. Got him over to Prince Henry Hospital. He'd broken his ankle in, I think, about three spots. Anyway, they've left him in the main hospital. Well, of course, the governor's come in and he said, listen, he said, Levy's got medical attention. You know, you blokes go back to yourselves. It's all over. Well, we've all had a talk. We said, fuck going back to ourselves. We're fucking staying out. So we stayed out for another 2 days. It was,
2 days you stayed out of yourself. Fuck.
Oh, yeah. We couldn't do nothing.
Wow.
It was like a meeting a brick wall. They couldn't do nothing.
Yeah.
So they brought They brought the SWAT team in. They surrounded the jail.
What the fuck are they going to do from the outside? It's Katingle. You need comments. That's right. Like, you guys can't get touched.
I think that was just a public show, you know. Yeah. Oh, listen, we're on top of it, you know. But anyway, in the end, we ended up going back to ourselves. We called it off after about 2 days. And everything went pretty quiet. Then they ended up sacking the governor. They pissed him off on medical. He ended up going around the twist. He apparently it drove him fucking mad. Anyway, they had a new governor in. They brought the deputy became the governor of Katingle. Everything sort of calmed down a bit, you know. Of course, there was an airplay about Russell escaping. Then in February, they handed down the recommendations of the Royal Commission. And one of the first recommendations of the Royal Commission was that Katingle be shut.
Yes.
And irrevocably shut because it was a danger to the mental health and psychological health of everybody that was in there. And if any man, one psychiatrist gave evidence and said that if any bloke remains in there longer than 6 months, he'll be either psychologically or psychiatrically damaged. Now, in my case, I was in there 2 years, 8 months. Earl was in there about 2 years. Fred was in there the same as me. Wow. Jimmy Murray, we're all in there at least over 2 years, yeah. 8 months, 2 years.
Yes.
So, you know, prison department didn't really give a shit about what the psych said. They made a recommendation to shut the place. Well, the premier was a bloke called Neville Wran at the time. And Wran, he got stymied by the prison union. Now, the prison officers union said, look, if you shut the place, we've got nowhere to put these dangerous men. Now, you're talking about 20 blokes at the most, maybe 25 in the whole state. And they're saying that these blokes have got to be contained in those circumstances. Otherwise, we can't run the jails.
Yes.
Right? So there's to and fro between the government and the Prison Officers Association. Well, bottom line was, Wran stalled on closing Katingle. It was supposed to be closed in January, February. Well, he kept on stalling. We're in mediation with the Prison Officers Association. We've got to work out where we're going to put these prisons. Rah, 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 rah. Well, in May, there was a break-in. And a couple of blokes cut through the bars. They broke into Katingle. They cut through the bars on the yard.
Broke into Katingle?
Yeah.
From the outside they broke in? Okay.
From the outside, yeah. And they were halfway through cutting through the main steel doors. Well, Jimmy Murray was in the cell next door to me, and he knocked on the wall. And he said, burn, burn. He said, look out the skylight. Like there was a window that you could see out from your cell, out in the yard. And all I saw was this shower of sparks. There was just a fucking massive shower of sparks. He said, they've come back. We're on our way home.
we're looking there
and we see all these sparks. We know exactly what's going on.
Yeah.
Well, there was a screw and his name was Parker.
Right.
I'll never forget him. He wasn't a bad screw in the blockhouse. He wasn't too bad. Anyway, he was Indian or Sri Lankan. Anyway, he was from one of those nations.
Yeah.
And I've never seen a screw go the colour of fucking white like he did. And he couldn't believe what he was seeing.
It's like a movie. Up,
he thought he was imagining things.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he's looked out and he's fucking shit himself. Well, he hit the button and the alarm's gone off. Fucking ee-oh, ee-oh, ee-oh. Well, of course, the boys that were cutting through, they've escaped. They've got away.
Yes.
The shit hit the fan. There was a break in at fucking Katingle, rah, rah, rah. And, there was holy hell to play. Well, it was about the 6th of June. I said, yeah, right, they cleaned them out. So they cleaned us out. Half of us went to Parramatta and the other half went to Maitland. I went to Parramatta with Jim and Fred and all the rest of them. The rest of them went to Maitland. And that sort of was the closing episode of Katingle. It was shut.
Wow.
That was it. That's how it shut. I ended up back at Parramatta. It was Parramatta and the governor was a bloke called Harry Duff. I'd call him reasonably fair, but he was a knockabout sort of a governor. He knew the jail. He was one of those blokes that if there was dramas, he'd walk in there and talk it out with the crim. Not like these ones now.
He'd come down at a respectful level and yarn it out with you rather than send in the squad.
And, you know, they were rare. Back in those days, you know, you sort of had a grudging respect for screws like that. Well, Duff said, well, listen, look, there was about eight of us there. And he said, right, he said, this is the ball game. I'll let you out one at a time. The first one that fucks up, you all go back in the circle. But if you behave yourself, you can stay in the jail. There's no problem. Just, that's what I want. I don't want any drama.
Yeah.
So, and that's what he did. He farmed us out one at a time. I was about the fifth bloke out, sixth bloke out. And that's how we got back into mainstream, out of the tracks. And that was the end of my track days.
Do you think, Bernie, no one can ever, other than you men that went through that and were there, could ever truly understand the psychological side of that? I mean, I look at a man whom I met you when I was a young bloke at the Central Industrial Prison that you escaped from many, many, many moons before. I remember you as a very, and people will pick up on this, a very educated man. You're an educated man that had done a lot of fucking tough jail, more than, you know, anyone I'd ever known in my life.
Yeah, there was a couple of turning points. When I got back to Parramatta, when I got out, there's a couple of things that happened. There was the tunnel from one wing. There was the best way to explain this
is don't put a criminal in escapee on a fucking ground level cell.
I'll fill you in on a bit of the story. The best way to explain this, explain what I'm about to explain, is this. The X-Tracks, X-Graft and X-Katingle tracks, we had, a network. It was like a brotherhood.
Yes.
Now, if you hadn't been through Graft and you hadn't been through Katingle with us, then you weren't part of it. Like, I could know you in the jail and I say, hello, do you have a cup of coffee with you? But you wouldn't be
you
involved
me brother.
In ink on gold.
No
way in the world.
No, I get it.
You'd always 100%. Be held at arm's length.
Yes.
But those blokes that have been in that, bounded by brutality and bounded by isolation and solitary,
you
we
can't
had a
break
tight
that.
Little bond.
Yeah, no.
That's part of how the tunnel started.
Yeah.
Now, Tony Lanigan, he'd been in Katingle. Tony was an extract. And he'd worked out a way that Tony was an educated bloke too, and he was really into New South Wales history, particularly convict history. And he came up and he was talking about it in the blockhouse one day. He said, listen, he said, in the old days at Parramatta Jail, he said, you know, the governor's house across the road. I said, yeah. He said, well, they used to take the prisoner from the fucking jail in a tunnel.
Underground.
And come up in the dock at the governor's house.
Yeah.
I said, oh, yeah, that's interesting. He said, well, that means there's tunnels under the jail. Like from reading books and hearing the stories and that, he'd come to the conclusion that it was a tunnel somewhere under the jail. Well, it wasn't actually a tunnel. What it was and what he'd found is he dug through the floor of his cell, and he was on the bottom floor in one wing. And when he dug through it, he'd come into another set of cell blocks underneath, which everybody had forgot about, which nobody knew about. And it was another set, and that was the tunnel. So in the old days, the three-tier cell block must have been four tiers.
Yes.
Or they had
underground segro or something.
Well, as the years went past and there was buildings made in the jail, the plans had got misplaced somewhere and everybody had forgot. Well, anyway, he got in there, he figured it out and started digging the tunnel. Well, a couple of extracts became involved. Well, there was a lot of us, without talking out of school.
Yeah, no, you're right.
A few extracts that were involved with helping and fucking supplying gear and all the rest of it. At one stage, I was up in the third tier, and one of the blokes gave me a walkie-talkie. And he said, listen, Byrne, keep an eye on the tower, because the tower was right opposite me. I could see where the screw was.
Yep.
So I used to talk on the walkie-talkie while they were in the tunnel downstairs, and I'd tell them where the screws were, where the screws weren't. Now, that was only one incident, but other blokes got chipboard and supplied gear for them, and, it was a communal effort.
Wow.
Now, there was one bloke that was involved. His name was Mick Murphy. Now, Murphy became involved in the tunnel, and it was near completion, and they were just a blade of grass away from going home. Anyway, what happened is Murphy got a visit from his girl, And he said to his girl, listen, I'm going home. I want you to have a car at the end of the jail tonight or tomorrow night, whenever it was. And she said, why? She said, I'm escaping. He said, I'm escaping, but I don't want to go with the rest of them. There was quite a few blokes involved. I don't want to go with the rest of them just in case they kill someone. I don't want to be involved. That was his story to his girl. Well, his girl's gone home to mum and said to mum, listen, mum, will you look after the kids tonight? I've got to go out. And, of course, mum said, no, they're your kids. You look after them. Where you got to go? Anyway, there's a lot of to-ing and fro-ing and all the rest of it. Well, of course, she's told mum, look, Mick's coming home. I've got to go and pick him up. Well, of course, mum's hit the panic button. So she's rang up the jail.
Oh, shit.
And she said, there's going to be an escape.
No.
And, of course, whoever answered the phone said, what do you mean there's going to be an escape? She said, oh, look, I've got it on good authority. There's a tunnel there. Someone's going to dig out, or they're digging out in a tunnel or something. Anyway, the screw fucking thought it was just a maniac. And I think he was half pissed. Anyway, she's rang up again. Well, the governor, he said, who's the bloke? Who's the crim? She said, Mick Murphy. So that night, it was about 7 o'clock, about half past 7, we heard him coming into the wing. Well, of course, everyone who knew what was going on was looking out the door, see what the screws are coming in the wing for.
Yeah.
Well, they go to Murphy's cell. He's in the cell with a bloke called Terry Humphreys. And, they go to that cell, and they drag Murphy out. Now, story goes that they gave him a couple of backhanders. They found a couple of keys on him and said, what's going on? And he's spilled his guts. Well, of course, the next minute they go up to Tony Lanigan's cell, and the rest is history. They find the tunnel and fucking all hell breaks loose. But the bottom result to that was this. Murphy gets rewarded for being an informer.
Yes, yes.
And they send him to camps and all the rest of it. And they send him to Silverwater.
Yes.
Now, Silverwater in those days has got a wire fence around it.
It was works release pretty much, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was just like you didn't need to escape.
C2, C3 fucking camp.
Yeah. Mm. Anyway, they send him to Silverwater, and, of course, the bottom line is he escapes. Well, he walks away. He teams up with a group of blokes, and about 6 weeks later, Anita Cobby ends up in a raped and murdered in a paddock out near Prospect.
Yes.
Now, I don't know whether they're guilty or whether they're not guilty. All I'm saying is if Murphy hadn't have been rewarded for being an informer, maybe Anita Cobby would be alive today.
His face was burned into Australia's collective memory. And today, Anita Cobby's killer, Gary Murphy, was seen in public for the first time in 33 years.
He was one of five men, including his brothers Michael and Les, jailed for life for raping and killing the 26-year-old beauty pageant queen.
Yes. And, of course, Tony, he went a bit troppo after the tunnel came undone because Tony was doing life too. And the last I heard, Tony escaped in 1993, 1994, and he's never been found. So if he's still out and about, good luck to you, son.
Yeah. I want to touch on your achievements, mate. You know, you've got so much to say fuck the system for. Here you are these years later, gone through all these traumas and brutality. And so, look, no one's taken away from it, mate. You rob fucking banks. We commit the crime. We do the time. We accept that.
That's right.
What came with that wasn't okay. You had every right to really continue to down that path and just fuck it all or flip the coin. And, mate, what a coin you flipped. What a coin you flipped. The accolades speak for themselves. There's not a crim that's alive today, especially with your background, that has a master's in journalism, correct?
Yeah. A bachelor in mass communication, majoring in journalism, yeah.
And with the accreditations that you've got, the awards that you've gone up on, 2 out of 3 you've won. What a story of redemption, Bernie.
And it's all up in your home state too.
It is, mate. Yeah, well, you kicked off with the Gold Coast Bulletin, my worst enemy. Yeah. But, it's good to hear that did something good for you, though, because I think truly, and I read that extract, and I really think, mate, the way you write as a journalist, as a man, mate, I don't know how to say it. I'm not the most smartest bloke in the room, but the way you put things into words and read, I can't sit down and read things unless they grab me. How does a man go from a violently notorious bank robber? And let me say, you never harmed anybody, never wanted to harm anybody, and we never went with any intentions to shoot anyone, as people may believe a bank robber does. John Killick made the same statement. He was never, ever going to kill anybody. It wasn't his go. Yep. He was there for the money, and that was it.
And that's it.
Let's just focus for a second on your redemption story, because it is an amazing one. And
it started off in Parramatta when I got out of Katingle. Because I could put two words together, a couple of the crims decided I'd make a good editor for the jail magazine. So I took over the jail magazine and I started writing. And as I said, there was a woman called Ann Summers at the National Times. Now, Ann got in touch with me and she said, look, she said, I've got a job for you. I said, oh, yeah, what's that? She said, will you do a book review for the National Times? I said, yeah, sure. So the book was a book called Angel Face, The Making of a Criminal. And it was written by a bloke called Wally Proben in London. Anyway, I did the book review, got paid for it, but that was my start.
Right.
I started. So I thought, yeah, well, this isn't a bad gig. You know, I could put two words together. And as I said, I was running the jail magazine. And it became a bit radicalised under my editorship, though. And a lot of stories were written about police verbal, police corruption, and stuff like that. And
they tried to block you, didn't they?
Oh yeah. It sort of created a bit of drama.
Yep.
But I think the biggest drama I caused was the 1978 edition of the Contact magazine, the Christmas edition. I did an interview with Jockey Smith, and it dealt with police corruption in those days and police verbal and all the rest of it. Well, of course, the police union wanted the magazine banned. There was a newspaper reporter from, I think it was the Sydney Morning Herald. He wrote an article, and he had to have based his article on reports from either the police or prison guards, because they were the only ones who could get news reports out in those days. And he virtually said, look, the interview Matthews did with Jockey Smith and Billy Sutton was a fabrication. Jockey Smith wasn't even in the jail, blah, 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 blah. Well, of course, I've gone to the governor and said, listen, this is all shit. You know, I wrote the story and you censored the magazine. And I did the interview. And he said, yeah, well, what do you want to do about it? I said, I want to complain to the press council. He said, yeah, you can do what you want. So that's what we did. I complained to the press council. I became the first prisoner-initiated complaint to the Australian Press Council about the media in Sydney bagging the crims in jail, saying that we're liars when we weren't. A university lecturer at New South Wales took the case up. They ended up winning the case, but they wouldn't have, you know, they wouldn't come overboard and say, well, look, the crims are right and they're wrong. But the fact of the matter is, we kicked the goal. So from that point on, I started getting into the news, getting into the media, and I started studying it and carrying on and writing a few articles here and there. But it wasn't until I went to Queensland. I was up in Queensland, and I met a bloke called Dave Halpin. Now, David Halpin was a Walkley Award winner, and he worked at the Gold Coast Bulletin. Strange it may seem, he was a union rep at the Gold Coast Bulletin. And he'd heard my story and wrongful imprisonments and all the rest of it, which I won't go into in detail.
But no, you're right.
He wrote a couple of stories about me, and he knew that I could put two words together, and he got me a start as a freelance journo as a freelance writer. I wasn't a journo then, because I didn't have a piece of paper that said I could write. He got me a kickstart with a bulletin, you know, just submitting freelance articles. I wrote main feature articles, 1,000 words, 1,500 words, and a lot of them got published. I got to know the editor at the Bulletin, and everyone, in the initial stages, they expected me to write about crime and all the rest of it. But, which was my forte. Like, I could handle that. There was no problem there.
Sure.
But I fell onto a story, and I guess this was the real start of my journalism career. It was International Women's Day, and my missus at the time said, listen, Byrne, why don't you go along to the International Women's Day, because Colleen McCulloch is the guest speaker. I said, I'm not interested in that shit. She said, oh, look, she said, you know, if you write about women's issues from a male point of view, no one else has done it. It'd be a good kickstart.
Yeah, well, of course. Cool.
Yeah, but she didn't nag me, but she kept on about it. In the end of it,
fuck it.
What I'll do is I'll go, at least I might be able to interview Colin McCulloch.
Yes.
And I'll get a free food and a free beer.
Yes.
So that was my motive. So away I go.
It's like going to church, anyway, the chapel, ain't it? In the booth, mate. You get your cup of cordial and your fucking biscuits.
Yeah, that's it.
I'm here to praise the Lord.
I go along, and anyway, I'm listening, and I get introduced to one of the people that put the do together. I forget her name at the moment. Anyway, I said, look, I said, you know, Colin McCulloch, any chance of her to talk? Yeah, all right. I said, listen, who put this do together? She said, oh, we did, as an organisation called Zonta. I said, Zonta? I said, what's Zonta? She said, Zonta is an organisation of professional women, an association of males, you know. But this is women who have succeeded in society.
Okay.
And at the time, Lynne Ford was the governor of Queensland. She said, Lynne Ford is a member of Zonta. I thought, oh, yeah. Anyway, I'm listening to her telling me all about this organisation called Zonta. And I said, where did you get the name? You know, how do you, you know, what's the name stand for? She said, oh, it came from the Sioux Indian in America. In those days, when the Braves went out to fight or went out to hunt, the women were left behind in charge of the old people and the children, and they were the main people, and that's how they attained their power. And I thought, oh, yeah, I said, that's an interesting story. I listened to what Colin McCulloch had to say. So I had the guts of a good story.
Yep.
So I put a story together. Custer's last stand, the Sioux Indian, how Zonta came into being and how they help underprivileged women and girls in other countries in South Africa, et cetera, South America. Anyway, I took the article up to the Bulletin, handed it over to, I think it was Fane Weaver at the time, and he said, well, look, he said, I'll introduce you to the woman in charge of the women's section. And, oh, here we go. So I go down there, and she said,
fuck.
Oh, that's a brilliant article.
Yeah.
I'll have that. We'll publish it. I said, oh, okay, fair enough. So I get paid, I've got a free food, and I've got a drink, and I'm sweet. Well, about 3 days later, and this is when the story begins, the woman rings me up again and she said, oh, Bernie, she said, look, that was a brilliant article. It's the first time Zonta's ever been mentioned in the Queensland media, blah, blah, blah. Look, thanks for all your help, rah, rah, rah. I said, yeah, no problem. Would you like any other stories? Well, the guard's gone straight up. It's like being back in jail. You know, dink, straight up. Oh, yeah, what's coming?
Yeah.
Anyway, I said, well, it all depends. And she said, what do you know about bagasse? I said, what's bagasse? She said, it's a byproduct of the sugarcane industry. I said, well, what's to do with bagasse? She said, well, my niece and her husband, they live down in the Tweed Valley.
Yeah,
and down there, there's a bagasse stockpile.
Yep.
And the bloke stockpiles it for fertiliser for Moolumbar Council and the Gold Coast Council.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. And, said, and it's infected all the homes along the way, the dust and that.
Yep.
I said, really? Well, I'm imagining something like asbestosis. That's what I'm figuring.
Okay, yeah.
So I go down, I meet these people, and, mate, it was one of the biggest stories of that year, this bagasse.
Wow.
And it turns out that it's an environmental health hazard, and here's a tip for you and your listeners. If you're ever going to buy mulch from anywhere, look at the bag. Now, they spell this shit BAGASSE or BEGASSE or BEGESSE.
Right.
But it's bagasse. And what it does is if you breathe it in, it inflames your lungs. It causes a real bad illness. It's not like asbestosis, but it makes you sick. It makes you very, very sick. I went to the bloke that had the stockpile because I had to interview him. And he said, I can't see anything wrong with bagasse. You know, I've been around it all my life, blah, 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 blah. I said, oh, yeah. I said, and you've never been sick? He said, no. He said, my brother died of cancer. Well, the warning light's gone up.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm thinking, I wonder. So I go to Gold Coast Council and they've got all these public, like revenue and how they pay money and shit like that. Well, they've got him down there and they've got him, they're paying him money, but not for bagasse. They were paying him for borrowing his water truck and borrowing this and borrowing that. And being an ex-crim, I'm thinking, oh.
Yeah, something's not
here.
Right.
They're pulling a raw here.
Yeah, exactly.
So I go back to him. I said, yeah, what's the story here? He said, well, that's bullshit. He said, they pay, and this is how they pay it, and they pay it by yard, and this is how they pay it. Well, of course, I've got all the information. So I put the story together, and I've taken it down to the Gold Coast Bulletin, and I've seen Fane Weaver. I said, listen, Fane, I said, here's the story. He said, Jesus Christ. He said, this is a gold mine. He said, have you got all the backup material? I said, yeah, here it is here. And I've given him all the information, all the backup, because I knew about corroborating evidence. I knew all about that because I've been through the court.
Yes, of course.
So I've got all that. So I've given him all that. Anyway, he said, mate, he said, we'll publish it in the Weekend Bulletin. I said, okay. Well, about 10 o'clock, half past 10 that night, he rings me. He said, listen, Byrne. He said, we've had to pull the article. I said, why? Oh. He said, well, the editor said it could be defamatory. I said, how's it defamatory? Because I also knew about defamation laws, but absolutely. I didn't say that to them because they didn't know. They knew I was a crim, but they didn't know.
They didn't know how deep.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They didn't know how much around the traps I'd been.
Yes.
So anyway, he said, no, look, he said, the editor's, you know, it's final. He won't publish the story. I said, all right, mate, okay, fair enough. Well, Dave Halpin had left the Bulletin by then, and he was a stringer for the Sun Herald. The Sun Herald had just broken into Queensland and had an office on the Gold Coast. So I've gone up to his office. I said, listen, Dave. I said, I've got a problem. I said, I've written this story. I've done a lot of research on it. I said, it's all 100% true. I said, now these people are getting sick because of this garbage. I said, but the Gold Coast Bulletin won't publish it. And they reckon it's defamatory. I said, will you have a look at it? So Dave had a look at it. He said, there's no defamation there. I said, are you sure? I said, yeah. He said, have you tried anywhere else? I said, no, mate. He said, look. He said, I'll ring the editor of the Sun Herald in Sydney. He said, I'll see what he's got to say. So he rings him. And he said, listen, John, he said, I've got a young bloke up here, Bernie Matthews. He said, he's a bit of a knockabout. He's done a bit of jail.
I like the way you worded that. Got a young bloke. You're still looking good, mate. You're still looking good. I can tell you that much. You haven't dropped a day in the fucking 30 years ago that I've seen you.
He said, look, he said, you know, I don't really give a shit about, you know, what he's done and what he hasn't done, as long as it can be corroborated, as long as the story's 100%.
He got the evidence.
I know the bloke, and I know he's done the homework.
Absolutely.
So they sent the story to Sydney. They jumped on it. Two-page spread in the Sun Herald. I get paid. Everybody's happy. You know, the story's out there, but it's published in the Sydney paper. His secretary rang me up about 2 or 3 weeks later. She said, listen, Bernie. She said, it's so-and-so here from John's office in the Sun Herald. I said, oh, yeah. She said, look, she said, we're getting all this mail for the reporter who wrote the story about bagasse. She said, look, what do you want me to do with it? I said, oh, send it up to me. She said, do you want it? I said, yeah, send it up. So she sent it up. And, mate, there was a heap of them. And they were all from South Johnson Mill, Mossman Mill.
Yep.
All the mills.
Yes.
And all these people were writing saying, listen, we've got a story here, blah, blah, blah. And I've read them all, and I'm thinking, Jesus, there's another story here. I interviewed a lady called Val Miles. And Val, she was a dear old lady. And anyway, I said, look, I said, you know, you wrote, like, oh, you're the reporter. Yeah, rah, rah, rah. Anyway, she said, look, she said, you know, my hubby was a truck driver, and he used to go in and out of Mossman Mill, and he used to drive past the bagasse stockpiles, and he got very sick, and he died. I said, really? She said, yeah. She said, I've got his death certificate. I've got all that and blah, blah, blah. So she sent me all that down. So that was the start of the story. Then they put me onto a bloke at South Johnson Mill. It sounded like he had throat cancer when you talk to him on the phone. You know, right. It was a very raspy voice. And his name was John Tarrar. I rang John and I said, look, I said, I'm a journo, blah, 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 blah. I'm writing a story about the gas. What can you tell me? So he told me his story, and his story was basically he'd contracted bagasosis. Now, bagasosis is a disease caused by bagasse. And he'd had all his medical certificates and he was really, really in a bad way, suffering from this bagasosis.
Shit.
So I got his story. Then there was a union rep from up past Mossman. I forget where it was. It was one of the other mills right up there. He was a union rep. And he said, oh, look, I'd like to talk. He said, yeah, what do you want? Anyway, he's told me about what was happening in the mills up there. He said, I've got a union What's going on here? The battery. The battery's gone. 5%. That can't be.
You're right.
But the bottom line was the second article got published and it just created a storm. Then Queensland covered it up. Now, in 1993, 1994, Queensland was Australia's biggest exporter of sugar, and that was the bottom line, money.
Wow.
That was the bottom line, brother.
I'm absolutely speechless at Bernie's story. An amazing man, and what an inspiring human. To have gone what he has gone through, to come out the other side with a wonderful story of redemption. Next week, a new episode. Russell Mansour, 23 years jail. He was a heroin addict, bank robber, and he turned his life around to help over 7,000 people.
And in that time, one wing at the Central Industrial Prison of Long Bay, that housed some of the worst sex offenders in the state at the time.
Yep.
And in my case, a necrophiliac. So they placed me with two sex offenders I had a mattress on the floor, and as soon as I got in there, there was jokes about jump up here, mate, and look after this. And I was horrified.
Oh, bro.
And I won't go into too much of the details, but I was sexually abused by both of them men that night. and something that don't sit too easy with me and still don't. And
no, I'm looking in your eyes now, and we're talking about this all these years later, and I can see the emotion in your face right now.
And then the next day, a notorious necrophiliac, he gave me my first shot of heroin there with an old, dirty old syringe that had a nail as a plunger.
You know, was this your choice that you just wanted to numb yourself, or was
he just said, basically it was like, you know, you do this and then you do this, you know what I mean? And then there's the sexual act after it. And it was like, I think it was what his way was if I give you this, you've agreed to do this.
Yep. This is the clink. These are the stories of redemption.
For the record, I'm done trying to make y'all comfortable.
That's right.
For the record, you ain't trying to grow, then it's done for you.
That's right.
For the record, lab on me going all the way.
All the way.
For the record, ain't trying to link, no time to waste.
Stop calling.
For the record, for the record.